Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William O. Beeman, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. Best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, he has served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. He is the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, and his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. Welcome to Background Briefing, William O. Beeman.
Thank you very much. I'm so pleased to be with you.
And you have an article in the Huffington Post, the Iran Accord, profoundly and primarily symbolic. You argue that both sides, the U.S. and its partners appeared tough and got very little. Iran appeared tough and gave up very little. Both sides save face. This is essentially no one won and no one lost. So if indeed this is more about symbolism than substance, where do you think we'll start seeing results? If presumably symbolism, if it's more powerful than substance, eventually is going to lead to more substance, right?
Well, look, I'm an anthropologist, and as an anthropologist, I can tell you that I believe profoundly in the power of symbolism. It is one of the main driving forces in human behavior and in human life. And in this case, the symbolism is extremely important. We have very short memories in the United States. We forget that Iran already suspended its uranium enrichment as a show of good faith in 2004. In fact, from late 2003 till beginning of 2006. And this was in conjunction with negotiations that were taking place with the European powers and Iran. The United States absolutely refused to participate in these negotiations, and the fact that Iran had suspended its uranium enrichment was actually decried by President Bush as a cynical move and as meaningless and so forth. The thing that was different about those talks and the talks that took place in Geneva is that the United States wasn't present. And I think everybody knows that the principal difficulty in foreign relations with Iran is not with any of the European powers, it's with the United States. The European powers, all of them, continue to have embassies in Tehran. They all have ambassadors. They all have Iranian representation in their capitals. They never cut off diplomatic relations with Iran. It was only the United States. So to actually have in Geneva the United States sitting down across the table to have our Secretary of State talking to Iran's foreign minister in prolonged discussions, it was amazing. And it was something that had not taken place in 34 years. Whatever they agreed upon, even if they'd agreed that that red is red and black is black and green is green, if they'd simply issued a statement of agreement about anything whatever, the fact that they agreed is actually almost more important than the substance of what they agreed to. Of course, both sides had domestic audiences that they had to placate, and so the United States had to seem like it was getting something out of Iran. Iran had to seem like it was getting something out of the United States. And indeed, both sides did get something, but quite honestly, what Iran gave up is something that was very easy for it to give up. And what the United States gave to Iran was actually to give back money that Iran already had. It was already their money, but it had just been frozen. And what the really important agreement here in these talks was the United States tacitly agreeing that Iran should be able, under the aegis of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, to continue to enrich uranium as part of its peaceful nuclear program. And this has been a point of contention in the United States. Wendy Sherman, for instance, before the Foreign Relations Committee in October this year, had said that the United States does not recognize the right to enrich as being specified in the nonproliferation treaty. But, in fact, President Ford in 1975 explicitly said that Iran has the right to enrich. In fact, the United States supplied the means by which Iran could enrich uranium. So we have already broken that particular statement. That's water over the dam. And for us to claim that the United States never recognized that is wrong.
Again, I'm speaking with William O. Beeman, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. Best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, he has served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. And he's the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. Let's talk about your book, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. As much as this is a breath of fresh air in this vexed relationship that's gone on for 34 years, it did start, after all, with the hostage taking. We just got through with talking with Gary Sick, who served on the National Security Council as the point man on that crisis. The perennial Great Satan, Death to America stuff, I think does, filter down into the heartland of America, and Americans just don't like that, you know.
Well, I don't want to repeat any. I'm sorry I didn't hear what Gary Sick had to say. I mean, he obviously is one of our great experts on Iranian foreign relations and on American foreign relations with Iran. He was part of military intelligence for many, many, many years and sat on the National Security Council. And his book, All Fall Down, is an excellent and a very excellent introduction to the Iranian Revolution and its aftermath. But he probably told you that the story didn't start with the hostage crisis or even with the Iranian Revolution. But in modern times, the real problem started with the deposing of Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1952-1953. The United States at that time was afraid that Prime Minister Mossadegh was going to be weak and was not going to be able to resist Soviet influence. And also, he had nationalized the Iranian oil company, which made the British and the United States mad. We had a new young Shah on the throne who was very irresolute and rather dissipated as a young fellow, and the public were supporting Mossadegh, and the Shah fled the country. The United States and the CIA engineered a coup that brought him back, and the hostage crisis was precipitated by the fact that the Shah, having left Iran during the revolution, was very sick, and no one knew it, and he came to the United States for treatment. And the Iranians were dismayed because they thought that the United States was going to do a repeat of what had happened with Mossadegh. And the Shah was in the United States to plot with the U.S. To overthrow the revolution and reinstate him on the throne. The United States didn't allow Iranian doctors to actually examine the Shah. And as a result, students occupied the U.S. embassy, and things got out of hand, and it lasted 444 days. So this is something that some American intelligence and political officials have never forgotten. They've never forgiven Iran for this. And despite the fact that we had a settlement, the Algiers Accords, in which, by the way, the United States agreed never to interfere in Iranian internal affairs again, the taint of the hostage crisis has remained, and people are still quite mad about it.
You know, I've never understood, William O. Beeman, why it was that Carter allowed the Shah in at the urging of Henry Kissinger.
It's a little hard to. Well, the Shah was our friend, and if you remember, just before the revolution, the Carters knew that the Shah was in trouble, and they actually traveled to Tehran spend New Year's Eve with the Shah in a very, very, kind of highly, again, symbolic show of support. Carter announced that he couldn't imagine anyone with whom he would rather spend New Year's Eve than the Shah and his wife. When push came to shove, he had announced to the world that the Shah was this great friend of the United States. And when the Shah was really sick with cancer, it became very, very difficult to refuse them entry to the States. They had refused them refuge from the revolution. The Shah went to Egypt, he went to Morocco, and sort of all around the world. But it was when it was very clear that he was dying. That was when the Carter administration and Kissinger said, look, we can't really abandon this person. I mean, politics aside, he's been our friend and staunch supporter, and we really have to help him. As it turned out, it didn't help. He did die. But as I say, the Iranians knew nothing of his illness, absolutely nothing. So you can understand how they would think that the pattern of the 1950s, the Mossadegh pattern, was repeating itself.
Well, given this history, then, do you think, and it's clear that the hawks on both sides have dominated the narrative up until now, do you think the doves on both sides now will be able to establish an enduring dialogue?
You know, we have to understand that oftentimes serious political change never takes place until a generation, sometimes two generations, passes. Right now, the vast majority of Iranian citizens don't have any knowledge of the revolution. They don't have any knowledge of even Ayatollah Khomeini because the population is very young. And here in the United States, since I teach at a university, I can tell you that the American students that I teach, and even many, many young adults, have absolutely no knowledge of the Iranian Revolution or the hostage crisis. It's now part of their history books. And so their emotional attachment to these events is very shallow or doesn't exist at all. So the political climate in both countries is such that, you know, you now can talk about some kind of reconciliation with Iran. Even President Obama was just a kid when these things took place. So he has no personal stake or involvement in this.
Well, I think the fact that he's maybe a lame duck, I mean, he's still getting screamed at from the right. By the way, it's not entirely sure that the Congress is not going to try and scuttle this deal, and that the president may have to veto legislation invoking even more sanctions. It's not entirely clear that the House won't and the Senate won't try and kill this deal, or the Republicans won't try and kill this deal.
You know, of course, the politicians will try to do anything, but one has to remember that the negotiations are taking place in the framework of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is signed by 189 nations, including the United States, including Iran. It guarantees Iran the right to develop peaceful nuclear energy. And as I pointed out to you, the United States has already recognized that uranium enrichment is part of that peaceful nuclear energy development, no matter what Wendy Sherman or anybody else says today. We have a history of recognizing it, and every European nation also accepts that principle. So the United States, as signatory to the treaty, also has the responsibility of guaranteeing the rights of non-nuclear weapons nations to that peaceful energy development. So if the United States makes the demand that, for instance, Israel would like it to make, and that is to totally dismantle the Iranian nuclear program, we are violating the treaty. We are violating the conditions of the treaty. And I think our legislators are not... They really don't seem to comprehend this. A treaty is a big thing. It requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate. With 189 other nations involved with the treaty, if Iran's rights are violated, then everybody's rights are under attack. So it is a very serious matter, and I think our lawmakers have to consider that particular situation. I realize there are many, many people in the U.S. Congress who really think that international treaties are just for the birds. You know, we should just scuttle them all and never have any international treaties that bind us to doing anything abroad. But frankly, if we're going to live in the world of nations, you can't live that way. That's really an impossibility.
Well, William Beeman, it's also always been quite counterintuitive on the part of the United States to make such an issue over the nuclear enrichment? Because my understanding is that it's not so much the government of Iran that's drawing this red line. The Iranian people are very sympathetic to the idea that they should have the right. It's a form of national pride on their part. So the idea, I mean, the neocons aside, they just want war. But the more pragmatic foreign policy people will argue that you need to drive a wedge between the people in this government, this theocratic government. Well, you couldn't have chosen a worse issue to drive a wedge between the people and this Iranian government, because the people apparently support the idea of Iran's right to enrich uranium.
Yeah, they absolutely do, and you know, and I think that I was listening to the last part of Gary Sick's discussion with you, and I think that there's no question in my mind that the nuclear issue was chosen by neoconservatives as a point that would be accepted by the people of the United States as a causus belli, a reasonable cause to attack Iran. Because what they really want is regime change. They don't like the Iranian regime. They don't like the Iranian government after the revolution, and so they'd very much like to see that government overthrown and replaced with somebody, with some people who would be more sympathetic to the United States, certainly less hostile toward Israel, in their minds. And the nuclear issue is a frankly, I think, a pretext, because the nuclear industry in Iran is 40 years old, and it was started at the instigation of the United States. And Iran has been carrying forward with this program pretty much as it was originally designed in the 1970s. One of the points in the discussions was the research reactor in Arak, A-R-A-K, Arak, right?
Right.
This research reactor started to be designed in the 1980s, so we've known about it for almost 30 years, but it never became an issue until like last week, frankly. The reactor it's well known. It's a heavy water reactor. It's designed to produce radioisotopes. It happens that one of the possibilities for the use of the spent fuel rods is to extract plutonium. But the plutonium can't be extracted from spent fuel rods unless you have a completely separate extraction plant. And Iran doesn't have such a facility. And furthermore, since Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, they are under inspection. Every single scrap and flake of fissile material in Iran is under the inspection of the International Atomic Energy Agency. This is what makes Iran different from, for instance, North Korea, who withdrew from the treaty, or from Pakistan or India, or frankly, from Israel. Israel has not a signatory to the treaty, and so therefore it has very little to say about anybody's treaty rights, because they haven't signed on.
Well, William O'Beeman, I thank you so much for joining us here. I appreciate it.
You're most welcome. You're most welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with William O'Beeman, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association, best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years. He has served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. He's the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the renewed tensions and divisions in Thailand that led to the military coup of 2006.